Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
I am 40-something years old, and to be honest with you, I'm not counting on Social Security being around when I need it. We'll tell you why today. Also, have you seen the stock markets lately? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the New Harvard Business Review, a source of smart thinking for today's business world. The revival of smart begins at hbr.org. And by MassMutual, for 158 years, providing policyholders with solutions to help meet their financial goals at massmutual.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 25th of March, and it is good to have you here. You take a good look at the age demographics in this country, and the news about Social Security today was only a matter of time. The Congressional Budget Office told the New York Times that this year, for the very first time, the trust fund is going to pay out more than it's bringing in from payroll taxes. That's about 5 years earlier than even the best guesses. So what gives? Why, a little thing called the Great Recession, don't you know? From New York, Marketplace's Elisa Roth has more.
The basic concept of the Social Security system is simple. We pay in through payroll taxes. Retirees take the money out as benefits. For decades, we paid more in than we had to pay out. But the recession changed that. Maya McGinnis is director of fiscal policy at the New America Foundation. She says, for one thing, less money is flowing into the system overall.
Wages were dropping with so many people out of work and not getting raises, so the trust funds were collecting much less money than we'd expected.
At the same time, we had to pay more money out.
More people couldn't find jobs, so they were retiring earlier and going ahead and collecting Social Security benefits.
Analysts always knew there'd eventually be more retirees than workers, and that we'd need more cash than there would be in the system. But they predicted it would be at least 2016 before the balance tilted. McGinnis says the change is an important reminder that Social Security desperately needs an overhaul. Henry Aaron is a policy analyst at the Brookings Institution. He says nothing fundamental about the system has changed.
The underlying facts are the same. Adjustments will need to be made, and they aren't very large. Small reductions in benefits or small increases in taxes would restore balance to the Social Security system.
There's no need for retirees to panic just yet. The Social Security Administration says benefits won't change this year. And in a few weeks, the agency will come out with its own projections about the state of the system. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
For those who are trying to add to their expected Social Security payouts with some gains in the markets, this has been a pretty good year or so. Today, granted, wasn't so great. We'll get to that. But the S&P 500 is just a couple of percentage points shy of where it was back in July of 2006. That was just about the beginning of a year-long bubble on Wall Street. So if we subtract the S&P's huge jump during that year before the crash, could you safely say that the stock market is now back to where it was in more normal times? That's what our senior business correspondent Bob Moon has been trying to figure out.
So you want me to define normal, do you? That's something even the experts are still struggling with. Just ask the chief economist at Standard & Poor's, David Weiss.
Trying to figure out exactly what normal is, let's face it, in the stock market, like all financial markets, equilibrium is something you fluctuate around. You sort of wave to it as you go by.
Weiss believes stocks are at what he calls reasonably normal valuations. But while the market might look healthy, the economy does not.
We're certainly not back to normal economically speaking. Unemployment rate's still approaching 10%. Growth is still sluggish.
So is consumer spending, which makes up the bulk of the U.S. economy. And the financial system, consumers, and the government are still staggering under heavy debt. Stock market veteran Michael Pansner writes the blog Financial Armageddon. He argues the market is being propped up by something highly abnormal, the ongoing handout from Uncle Sam.
There is some question, particularly in an environment where the government is heavily involved, whether the markets are really reflecting reality in the same way that they once did.
And what might happen when reality bites? Richard Sparks is chief equities analyst at Schaefer's Investment Research. He says lingering worries are keeping trading volumes and investor confidence abnormally low.
We don't know what will happen once we take the patient off life support, so to speak, to see if the economy can grow by itself.
Sparks says the reason stocks are up is that investors are predicting all will be well once that happens.
I think what the market is suggesting is that we're on the downside of all of those problems, that over time that those problems will be worked through the system and we'll be back to a sense of normalcy at some point.
But as S&P's David Weiss points out, normalcy depends on your perspective.
Things are okay only to the extent that we're not in free fall anymore. Up is better than down, but we got a long way to go before we get back to where you were. Certainly my portfolio has a long way to go to get back to where it was.
Unfortunately, a lot of Americans are finding that's the new normal. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Elsewhere in the markets, the foreign exchange markets specifically, it looks like the euro has been saved. Late today, there was an announcement from Brussels that France and Germany have agreed on a $30 billion deal to bring the lingering Greek debt crisis to a close. Half the bailout's going to come from the European Union, about half from the International Monetary Fund. Back here, Wall Street was enjoying a swell afternoon until somebody rained on its parade. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Digital, as you know, has not been kind to magazines and newspapers. Ad revenues are down, circulation numbers as well. Now comes a new media gadget that might actually give old media a boost. Apple's iPad goes on sale next week. And Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports that if they play their cards right, newspapers and magazines might finally be getting in on something that's good for their future.
When the iPad hits store shelves on April 3rd, you'll be able to read many newspapers and magazines on it, special iPad versions of them with special iPad ads. Publications like The Wall Street Journal and Men's Health are already getting premium prices for those ads.
They're quite satisfied and surprised that there's quick uptake.
Industry analyst Ken Doctor advises newspapers and magazines on the iPad. He says the new device offers old media an opportunity to do something it's struggled with for years, make money online.
Essentially, it's a do-over with a new platform and a new way of thinking about it. Can you charge advertisers in a different way? And can you say to readers, we're going to need you to pay for it?
So far, advertisers are on board. Many magazines have sold out their debut iPad issues. Chase's Sapphire Card bought out the iPad ad space for the New York Times. Joe Lazzito is with digital advertising firm Digitas.
It's already white hot right now, and I can see it continuing.
Lazzito says iPad ads can be interactive and offer information and entertainment that hadn't been possible. Sports Illustrated created a mock-up ad for Ford's Mustang that worked like a driving game. But Ford isn't buying iPad ads yet. Scott Kelly is digital marketing manager for Ford.
We try not to get too distracted by shiny objects. We're going to make sure that it's a platform that can both reach a lot of our consumers and engage them with our content.
Kelly says Ford's waiting to see if publishers can get readers to actually buy iPad subscriptions. Magazines like Esquire are charging about $3 for a single iPad issue. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
The Census Bureau says women control something like 80% of all the household spending in this country. Retailers and marketers being fairly quick on the uptake, they have geared a healthy proportion of the ads that we see to women, ads that are pretty heavy on images of motherhood, family, and happy couples. Unless, of course, they are cat food commercials, which seem to be almost entirely the provenance of the single woman. Thing is, more women are single now, getting married later, if at all, or becoming single again later in life. Ashley Milne-Tite would sure like to know why more marketers haven't caught on to that.
I was watching TV the other night when this Lowe's commercial came on. It shows a bubbly 30-something woman in her gleaming new home, alone. No handsome husband or adorable kids in sight. She's discussing her to-do list.
Somehow, updating the bathroom, it just hasn't gotten crossed off. I'm a grown woman, and I was scared of my own bathroom until I went to...
Okay, I won't admit to being scared of my bathroom, but I will admit to enjoying the ad. I felt a little glow of pleasure at the thought of that woman happily laying tiles and spreading grout. So how did a cynic like me get gooey over a home improvement commercial? Melanie Notkin says I finally felt included. She's CEO of SavvyAuntie.com, a website for women who don't have children.
America seems to talk to all grown-ups as we're part of an intimate family of a mom, a dad, and kids. Single people tend not to be spoken to or tend not to be part of the conversation.
Notkin says most advertisers actually have no idea how to talk to single women.
When they want the visceral feeling to be happiness, they're going to show what we qualify as a happy lifestyle, which is family. And people often assume that women who are not married are terribly unhappy.
That's what was nice about the Lowe's commercial. The woman was excited about her home, happy and independent. Given how many single women there are, I wondered why so few ads are aimed at us. 44% of women over 18 are single, 2% more than 10 years ago. Tracy Chapman directs strategic planning at consultancy firm Just Ask a Woman. She says advertisers want to pitch their products to a broad audience without offending anyone.
They need to justify why they would go after this specific target. I think they want to reach as many women as possible with the amount of money that they have.
But ad industry veteran Stephanie Holland says that's misguided. She's executive creative director at Holland & Holland Advertising. She says instead of going for one size fits all, advertisers need to target different types of women, or they're wasting their money. So why don't they? Because Holland says so many decision makers at brands and ad agencies are men.
Men have a difficult time distinguishing even among moms, much less coming in and understanding the single female.
She says marketers are missing a big opportunity to target people like me. She says they just need to work on making that connection.
An understanding of where you are in life, as well as tons of other people as single women, and making you feel good about it. And that's what's going to make you feel good about the product.
Take this upbeat approach from Chevrolet. A young woman fresh from a first date is picked up by a friend who whisks her away in a bright red Chevy Malibu. They hit the open road.
He said he was a professional student.
No.
Of life.
I'm so sorry.
Single lane ahead. I'll be in that lane.
In other words, girlfriends rule, at least for now. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
And now, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials managed to climb 5 points today, ended basically flat, 10,841. The Nasdaq knocked off a point near the center line at 2397. The S&P 500 fell nearly 2 points, a tenth of 1%, ended at 1165. Citigroup climbed nearly 3% today after a report that the Treasury Department could unveil a plan to sell its stake in the bank come April, which is not all that far away. Some companies made out on a boost in their profit outlooks. Qualcomm, the technical side of a lot of our phone conversations, engineered a 5% jump. Best Buy snapped up more than 3.5%. Oracle pronounced its stock more than a percent richer. eBay bid up 2.3% today after Credit Suisse upgraded the web auctioneer. First Solar warmed up 2.3% today. Kaufman Brothers reinstated their recommendation to invest in the maker of photovoltaic modules. Price in the 10-year T-note sank some more, nudged the yield up to 3.88%. Keep an eye on that one. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org. And by Vanguard, reacting to the stock market is investing. Taking stock in long term is vanguarding. More about vanguarding at vanguard.com. Keep an eye on Marketplace wherever you go. iPhone users can listen to updates on the economy and business, watch the Marketplace whiteboards, and follow the Scratchpad blog. Just visit marketplace.org on your iPhone.
from the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The Commerce Department releases its final gross domestic product report for the fourth quarter of 2009. In Rio de Janeiro, the World Urban Forum concludes. Established by the United Nations, the forum examines rapid urbanization. Over half of us live in cities and towns. And a ceremony takes place for the 2,403rd star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. The name on that star will be Dennis Hopper. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. So here's an interesting coincidence. The same day President Obama signed the health care bill, that'd be Tuesday, the medical school at Texas Tech University said it's going to start offering a 3-year program for people who want to be primary care doctors. Most medical schools, of course, are 4 years. Texas Tech is reacting to longstanding predictions that we're facing a big shortage of MDs and guesses that that shortage is only going to get worse as health care reform kicks in and millions of new patients try to find doctors. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has more.
We'll need an estimated 13,000 new primary care doctors to treat the millions of new patients who will be insured by 2014 when health care reform kicks in. So brace yourself.
There will be patients who get an insurance card, but they may well find that the practices in their area are closed to new patients.
Dr. Lori Heim is president of the American Academy of Family Physicians.
People will be getting care that's delayed or foregoing care until it's more costly.
After Massachusetts overhauled its healthcare system in 2006, requiring almost everyone to get insurance, the number of doctors accepting new patients dropped 10%. So more patients saw nurse practitioners, and patients started having group doctor appointments. Yep, you get to talk about your gallbladder in front of total strangers. Erica Drazen says it's not as bad as it sounds. She's a health policy analyst at Computer Sciences Corporation just outside Boston. She's talked to patients who've had group appointments.
So you listen to other patients' problems. You can get tips from other patients. Now, clearly, if they're going to do a physical exam, they go off in a private room to do that.
That's a relief. The healthcare overhaul does attempt to alleviate the doctor shortage. There's more funding to train new family doctors and nurse practitioners. And all the bickering in Congress about healthcare reform had an unintended benefit. The number of medical students going into family medicine increased by about 9% this year. Dr. Atul Grover is a lobbyist for the Association of American Medical Colleges.
All the discussion around the value of primary care that has gone on has really helped revitalize people's career interest in primary care.
Let's hope they don't change their minds. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
When you're up high in an airplane, flying from, say, New York to L.A., the ground below is really a bit of a blur. Mountains and rivers and lakes are visible, but the only other constant are the roads, thousands and thousands of miles of them. They're just there, and most people don't really think much else about them. Ted Conover has spent the past couple of years walking and driving roads all over the world for his latest book. It's called The Roots of Man. Ted, it's good to have you here.
Thanks, Guy.
The roads you have in this book run from those superhighways, you ride them in Africa, to a frozen river up in the north of India. I thought that was the most fascinating part of this book. Tell us that story.
That's a valley called Zanskar, which is just a few miles from the border with Pakistan and China. Not far from there are thousands of Indian troops who need food in the winter. So the government wants to build a real road through this gorge that leads in and out of Zanskar. Until they get around to that, and it's going to be a while because it's a gigantic project, the people in that valley get in and out on a frozen river during about 6 weeks of the winter when it's hard enough to walk on. So I found a group of kids who are using it to get to school outside the valley, and I walked with them for 4 days. It's a pretty amazing adventure if you're somebody like me, to see a road that's, you know, only a road for 6 weeks. But if you're them, they like can't wait till there's a real road.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, they say this is so embarrassing to have a road like this.
Did you find, generally speaking, that the locals living near these roads or these soon-to-be roads generally wanted them in? I mean, they saw it as progress?
Almost always. And that's a weird thing if you come from a developed place where you see the strip malls, you see all the bad things that happen with the road. They haven't seen that. What they see is that we've got things they don't have, and the road to them is the way to get everything.
You quote a buddy of yours at the end of this book, this guy who apparently you've spent a lot of time driving with, who said, you know, roads are funny things because they are fundamentally a means to an end. They're a way to get someplace. They're a way to get goods in and out. But they are also these purpose-built things, right? I mean, they're there for a total reason.
A road is an intention sort of made real, isn't it? I mean, we spend all this money, all this time to build the road. And what does it do? It disappears in our rearview mirror the minute we go over it. You know, if you're a follower of Kerouac, you feel this romance of the road trip. You feel that driving all night, probably heading west, is something that's going to change your life in a cool way. And yet you can reach this point of saturation where, gosh, another commute, another half-hour delay getting onto that bridge, and there's the end of that quote-unquote road. Yeah.
There's no choice, though. I mean, we got to have roads.
Yeah. I think you can't stop it, and so you try to plan. You try to do better than was done before. The book ends in Lagos, Nigeria, because that's a representative of the megacities where most of humanity will live in a couple more generations, where it's growing so fast that you cannot always do that planning. Try buying a street map of Lagos that tells you the names of those streets around the periphery. You can't do it. Nobody really knows. And it's kind of cool to be on these roads because they're there because people see opportunity.
Do the folks in, say, South Asia or Nigeria, do they look at Western economies like the United States or Europe and say, you know what, they have a pretty good transportation system. Let's try to figure out what they did right and copy that and leave the bad stuff behind.
You'd have to be daft not to think you need infrastructure to grow your economy. Everybody knows, you know, big highways are the key to moving ahead. It's preparing for the consequences that we're not so good at. You know, in the United States and Western Europe, we have vast studies at hand to try to figure out how to do a new road the right way, how to prevent noise pollution, how to encourage mass transit alongside when you can. But, you know, other places don't have those luxuries. The roads get built, and somehow we make do. We move ahead one way or another.
Ted Conover's most recent book is called The Roots of Man. Ted, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thank you, Kai.
Marketers are always trying to keep up, selling us the clothes we want to wear, the cars we want to drive, the 3D TVs we want to watch Avatar on, and the music we want to listen to. And not just the latest hits, either. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports now from New York that retro is getting an update.
There are 10,000 bars and clubs in New York City, and just about every one of them would love to be the it place for 20-somethings. DJ Lady Bunny's been spinning in the clubs of New York for 25 years. She says that demographic has always been a target for bar and club owners.
Because they're sexy, and for that reason they're allure to lascivious older people like myself. No, I mean, that slipped out.
But you can't rely on cheap drink specials alone to attract that younger crowd. And ironically, just playing the latest hits won't do the trick either. DJ Sean LaFleur says you gotta go retro. He spins at bars, clubs, and corporate parties. He says just as companies use familiar images to sell clothes or cereal, DJs have to give people something that brings out this reaction. People are going, oh my God, I can't believe I haven't heard this. Oh, did I buy this? Oh God. And what LaFleur is seeing now is going to make you feel really old. What used to be retro, the hits of the 80s, are going the way of parachute pants. Here's LaFleur's business partner, Dan Pfluger.
It was retro, it seemed like, for 15 years. And then in the past 4 years or so, we've moved into playing more other stuff.
And by other stuff, he's talking about the hits of the 90s.
in 2005, if you were playing the Spice Girls, you'd get probably laughed out of the gig. But now people love it.
Lady Bunny has been playing this song lately, too. She says those coveted 20-somethings just love it.
And as much as the DJ likes to educate and show stuff that they know that the general public might know because it's not top 40, a DJ with an empty dance floor is a DJ with an empty bank account.
Lady Bunny knows the drill. She's seen retro change several times over the years.
Every era has their own retro. In the 70s, there was a big 50s craze with Happy Days. The 80s ushered in a 60s revival.
And the 90s, she says, brought back danceable disco beats from the 70s, like in this oft-forgotten hit by Soul to Soul. So what do the 20-somethings think?
I get really psyched because that was my music. Like, that was the first music that I could lay claim to as like, oh, this is like ours. This is my friends and I listen to this.
That's Kayla Oberlin in Manhattan's hipster-filled East Village. Here's Jared Jeter.
I'm like, wow, this is really familiar. Yeah. Oh, man, I remember we had a high school dance of this and I didn't dance. And so when you hear it again, you're like, all right, maybe this is my chance.
Which is not to say he likes 90s music, but there's just something about a familiar tune that's, pardon my now dated reference, simply irresistible. And it seems to be keeping the New York club scene liquid. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture and creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. More at producemoreconservemore.com. By the new Harvard Business Review, a source of smart thinking for today's business world. The revival of smart begins at hbr.org. And by Putnam Investments, dedicated to helping financial advisors and their clients pursue a more comfortable retirement. You can get the latest at RothIRAblog.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
A final note today, one that does not bode well for the journalism profession. Researchers in Japan have apparently designed a robot that can see what's going on nearby, ask people questions about it, take pictures, write up a brief summary. Put it all online. I don't know. I'm not sure it's ever going to work out.
All right. Enough of that one. Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 5 points, basically flat. The NASDAQ down a point, also nearly flat. The S&P 500 fell 2 points. That's about a tenth of 1%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Tune in tomorrow morning to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest and earliest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this particular radio broadcast, the UK shoots for the stars.
To make sure that recovery has momentum, we have to identify those sectors where the UK is a real world leader, where the growth opportunities are going to be substantial, and where we have real competitive advantage. Space is one of those areas.
I'm Kai Rizdal. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.